I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Did James Baldwin give up on America? Our guest, Eddie Glaude Jr., says no. While Baldwin spoke and wrote eloquently about his rage regarding the country's long history of racial violence and its inability to tell the truth about itself, Glaude writes in his new book that Baldwin never gave up on the possibility that all of us could be better. The book is Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. Glaude says it took him a while to connect with Baldwin's writing. It was too personal and too painful, forcing him to confront his own wounds growing up in Moss Point, Mississippi. Eddie Glaude Jr. is the chair of the African American Studies Department at Princeton University, and he joins us on Radio Times by Skype to talk about what Baldwin can tell us about the moment we're in today, confronting the legacy of our country's racial and racist history. Eddie Glaude Jr., nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It is my pleasure. It is my pleasure. Delighted.
Well, and I thank you for writing this book because it made me revisit, and I have to confess it's been many decades now since I read James Baldwin's writings, but you took me back there because I felt like he does have something to tell us about today. Do you think James Baldwin time has come once again?
Well, there's been a renaissance of Baldwin's work, and we see him everywhere in some ways, particularly since Black Lives Matter emerged. You know, even in Baltimore, you know, ignorance allied with power is the most ferocious enemy of justice, a quote from No Name in the Street. Mm. You saw that poster, right, in Baltimore as the city burned. You heard from leaders of Black Lives Matter, you heard them invoking Baldwin, in some ways this vulnerable, fragile, queer Black man became in some ways an avatar for a challenge to a certain understanding of Black political leadership, right? In some ways he helped people queer Black politics in some ways, right? So, and of course, Raoul Peck's amazing documentary, I'm Not Your Negro, and then, of course, If Beale Street Could Talk. So there's been a renaissance around Baldwin's work and life that I think makes him especially important to these times.
Well, let me ask you about your more personal relationship with Baldwin, if I can put it that way. And you begin the book by talking about your struggle to both connect with him and perhaps even understand what he was saying about America, about being a Black man in America. Help us understand your struggle with James Baldwin.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Baldwin was always dangerous to me, you know, in the sense that he's an exacting companion. He demands a kind of honesty because, you know, he believes in the Socratic dictum that the unexamined life is not worth living. And so he translates that in a way that a precondition to say anything about the world requires that you explore the interior wounds and pain that make you who you are. Because Baldwin believes that the messiness of the world is actually a reflection of the messiness of our interior lives. And so there's this ongoing demand to tend to your wounds and to your pain. And I just wasn't ready to do that. And, I wasn't mature enough to do that. I'm still not mature enough to do it in some ways. But there's this also this sense in which whenever I read Baldwin with my colleagues, you know, he made them uncomfortable, my white colleagues. You know, he made them uncomfortable. He didn't allow them to sit by and just read the material and dispassionately. Oftentimes he left the ground scorched. Hmm. So I had to tend to them while I'm reading him and tend to myself. So it took me a while to just finally settle down. And once I did, 30 plus years ago, I've been reading him ever since. I've been walking with him ever since.
Well, you, and I don't want to spend the full hour talking about you, Eddie Glaude Jr., because we do want to talk about James Baldwin, but I was struck, and I'm always interested about how people connect with other people who obviously matter in their lives. But you grew up in the South in Mississippi. You ran away essentially from your life in Mississippi at 16. You both had difficult fathers. I mean, as you describe James Baldwin's father, he kind of terrorized his own family, and you had difficult problems with your stepfather.
Well, my father, he's my biological father.
Your father.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's such a beautiful journey. I end the book with my father, we tell each other we love each other all the time. He's calling me to tell me what to say on television, which is hilarious. But in those early days, when, you know, they were basically growing up, raising four kids, they were really young. And he could just look at me and scare me to death.
Yeah.
You know, he deposited a kind of fear in my gut that I've been grappling with ever since. But at the same time, you know, this is a guy who would wake up every morning and, you know, deliver mail in Mississippi heat. It would be so hot, he would sweat out his belts. They would rot and, you know, they would rot, as it were, because of all of the sweat and perspiration. Fix the same lunch every day for 5 days a week, a bologna sandwich with mayonnaise and mustard. I remember those. But he scared the living daylights out of me. And it's that fear that's at the heart of how can I put this, Marty? It's that fear that makes me the vulnerable little boy that I am.
Sure.
And Baldwin just forced me to grapple with that. Yeah.
Well, and his own father, I mean, you use the word terrorized his own family, called Baldwin ugly. And it seemed that the sort of painful relationship he had with his father, that sort of personal painful relationship, sort of mirrors the more painful political relationship that Baldwin had with the country.
Yeah, and you know, that's one of the brilliant features of Notes of a Native Son, right? As he's telling the story of his own kind of formation, right? We get this account of his father's descent into madness and eventual death, the birth of his younger sister, the riot that will consume Harlem at the moment. I mean, it's just this brilliant piece that kind of captures all of this, all of these elements. It's cinematic in some ways, right? But to read Baldwin, let me put it this way: Baldwin's judgment of his stepfather, or his father, as he always called him, mm-hmm. Changes over time. His judgment is much harsher in the early days. By the time Baldwin himself is on his deathbed, he's much more generous to his dad. He understands that he was a victim of a society that is constantly trying to deposit in us a profound sense of self-hatred. And so if you read Baldwin over the course of his career, you see the arc of his judgment of his stepfather change. And it's really beautiful to witness.
And perhaps mirroring his view of America changing as well?
Yeah, not so much mirroring, but there's a sense in which, you know, I've always kind of held this view that there's a through line in Baldwin's work, right? There is the unexamined life is not worth living, that we have to deal with who we are. We have to be honest. We have to confront our lies, our ghastly failures. And he is engaged in that kind of reflection under different material conditions. And so as America shifts and changes, as the social context shifts and change, Baldwin thinks differently. And so there's a moment, and the moment I latch on to is the moment of despair and disillusionment, yeah. This sense in which the country has turned its back once again on the possibility of being a genuine multiracial democracy. And Baldwin has to pick up the pieces.
James Baldwin, obviously an extremely important writer of his time, and even I think today as well, an observer of the country. Eddie, what did he understand uniquely about America?
Well, I think he that's a great question. I think he understood how deeply psychologically fraught this place is, how the lie has distorted and disfigured our characters such that we can't even become the kinds of people that democracy requires. Mm-hmm. He is, to my mind, the most insightful writer about American democracy and race that we've ever produced in this country. And I think it has everything to do with this insistence that the country has its beginnings in evasion, in a denial, in violence, right? He says, right, at the moment that the country was founded, it had to tell itself a lie, and that lie was rooted in the fact that these people that they knew were human beings, because they were chattel in their midst, they had to say that they were not human beings, because if they were not human beings, then there would no crime would have been committed. And Baldwin says, that lie is the source of our present trouble. Right. And so it cuts deep because it's not only about the dehumanization, the degradation of a particular people. It's about the effect of that dehumanization and degradation on the very souls and psyches of the people who are engaging in that practice, if that makes sense.
It does. And James Baldwin, I mean, he's so quotable, but one that I scribbled down, the horror is that America changes all the time without ever changing at all, which I think is just a brilliant observation.
Yeah, that's the through line, right? I mean, we tinker around the edges, but at the heart of this place, at the heart of this place is this belief that white people matter more than others. And that belief evidences itself in our dispositions, in our social, political, and economic arrangements, such that to tinker around the edges, right, isn't enough to uproot that belief. So even if you end slavery, if you don't uproot the belief, you're going to end up with Jim Crow. Even if you end Jim Crow, you're going to end up with these structural realities that continue to devastate the lives of people simply because of the color of their skin or their zip code or the like. So it's amazing how he saw that. And as he put it in 1962, Marty, he said, the trouble we're in is deeper than we think because the trouble's in us.
Because the trouble's in us. So why didn't he give up on America? I'll put it that way.
Because he didn't give up on us, on human beings, right? He says that, you know, he says in No Name in the Street, published in 1972, he says that, you know, we're at once miracles and disasters. And we have to protect ourselves from the disasters that we've become. So there's an abiding faith in the capacity of human beings to be otherwise. But he's not naive about the fact that we could be, you know, devilish, evil even, monstrous. So the faith is not in America. I mean, I actually write in the book this line where I say the idea of white America is irredeemable, but that doesn't mean we are. So we have to make the distinction between the two, it seems.
Well, let me quote James Baldwin one more time, and then we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with our guest, Eddie Claude Jr. He said, from my point of view, no label, no slogan, no party, no skin color, and indeed no religion is more important than the human being. Picking up on what you just said there, Eddie.
Neutrality of who we are is a beautiful thing.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take that short break. And I do want to get our callers in on our conversation, talking with Eddie Claude Jr. We're talking about his brand new book. It's titled Begin Again, James Baldwin's America, and its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. He is chair of the Department of African American Studies and the James S. McDonald Distinguished University Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, and has been a guest on Radio Times in the past when we've talked about race and politics. You can join us, Radio Times. At WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Go Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with Princeton professor Eddie Claude Jr. He said when he has felt despair, he has turned to the writing and the activism of James Baldwin to help him understand America and this moment that we're in. And again, we're talking about his new book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. I mentioned the fact that he is so quotable, but I do want to play a clip. This is from the documentary, I'm Not Your Negro, directed by Raoul Peck. And here he is talking about a program, The Negro and the American Promise, about the future of Black Americans. And I should add that he does use the N-word. We're going to talk about that. He uses it, I think, in a very specific and intentional way. It's about a minute 40, which is a little bit longer than what we normally play when it comes to a clip. But it's important, I think, to hear his words, also to hear some of the pauses as he speaks. Let's give it a listen.
I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter. So I'm forced to be an optimist. I'm forced to believe that we can survive whatever we must survive. But the Negro in this country, the future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. It is entirely up to the American people and our representatives. It is entirely up to the American people whether or not they're going to face and deal with and embrace this stranger whom they maligned so long. What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need him. And the question you've got to ask yourself, the white population of this country has got to ask itself, north and south, because it's one country, and for a Negro, there is no difference in the north and the south. There's just, you know, a difference in the way they, in a way they castrate you. But the fact of the castration is the American fact. If I'm not the nigger here, and you invented him, you, the white people, invented him, then you've got to find out why. And the future of the country depends on that, whether or not it's able to ask that question.
And again, that's James Baldwin speaking in 1963. Eddie, there is so much in there. I mean, we could spend a whole hour talking about that 1 minute and 40 seconds. But from your perspective, what do you hear? What is he telling us?
Well, you know, I think this is the conversation with Kenneth Clark, and I think he's rageful because they've just come back from this disastrous meeting with Robert Kennedy. And there is a sense in which he sees the recalcitrance, you know, the refusal to kind of address what's at the heart of this. But the clip is so important because it's the revolutionary inversion at the heart of Baldwin's corpus. He shifts, you know, we're not the white man's burden is turned on its head.
Right.
That I'm not the problem, you are. I've never been the problem. The question is, why do you need the N-word? Why do you need, you know, the terrorist Muslim? Why do you need, right, these enemies in order to consolidate your sense of yourself, right? Why do you need to, you know, as Cornel West might put it, why do you need to niggerize people, right? What's at the heart of that? And so Baldwin insists, and this is 63, he insists that we understand that black people understand that it's not us, it's them. And that and the only way we're going to get this right is that there has to be a forceful encounter with the reasons why that is needed. And in this early phase of his life, he believes that, you know, through our love, we can help them see themselves otherwise. But again, we're not the problem.
Do you think we're at a moment today to at least begin to confront and address the sort of basic conundrum of this country having to do with whiteness and race?
You know, I think we have an opportunity again to do so. I'm not sure what the outcome will be, you know, but I know we have a chance. And, you know, this moment is, you know, Marty, this moment is not about a how-to manual about anti-racism, right? We have to choose life. We have to choose a way of being together differently. And this is going to require a deep sea dive. Our history doesn't bode well. It doesn't suggest that we're going to do too well. But here we are.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see. I can't guarantee the outcome, though.
Well, you grew up in Mississippi, and just a week or so ago, Mississippi took down their flag that had that Confederate insignia, you know, as part of that flag. Do you see that as an important decision that was made?
Yes, an important decision. And then he signed legislation or vetoed legislation that would have helped poor black people and poor white people in the state of Mississippi at the same time, out of spite. So he, you know, so it happened simultaneously. As he was bringing down the flag because the SEC and other corporations and activists had been bringing pressure to bear. But at the level of policy, he was devastating poor people at the same time. So we have to be, you know, I think these symbolic shifts are really important. you know, the landscape is kind of rife with all of this imagery of the value gap, as I put it in my last book. But, you know, taking down a Confederate monument is, mm-hmm. is easy. But, you know, the highways in Chicago and New York and Philadelphia, those are monuments too, aren't they? They reflect a certain ideology of who's valued and who's not. We have a lot of work to do.
We certainly do. And I wrote this down, and I don't know if this is you, Eddie Claude Jr., or James Baldwin, but I'll just say it. But you say, and I think this is where you and Baldwin probably come together, which is the country faces a moral reckoning. Will we truly be a multiracial democracy? And what do we have to do to become that society? I mean, it seems like that's what you and I think Baldwin are asking us to try to figure out what to do.
Right. So, you know, one of the things about this book is that, you know, it initially started out as a biography, but then I realized I couldn't do that. So it's a book where I'm writing with Baldwin about our current moment. It's a combination of biography, social criticism, literary criticism, and the like. And so there are these moments where, you know, Baldwin is the wind beneath my wings so that I could say something about the moment. And I think this idea of us really, you know, struggling and grappling with what needs to happen for us to become a genuinely multiracial democracy, the choices we need to make. And, you know, Baldwin's shorthand is choose life.
Mm-hmm.
Don't choose safety. Don't choose the illusion of innocence. Choose life. And that requires confronting, you know, the ugliness of who we are so that we can release ourselves into a different way of being in the world together.
Well, and it seems one of his themes, if I can put it that way, is that we have to be able to speak honestly and truthfully about who we are as a country. And it seems we are at this juncture, whether it's tearing down statues or not. I mean, I think that's, as you seem to be saying, that's almost like the easy part and the more visible part. But, you know, how do we tell the truth about our country, and how does Baldwin help us do that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it has something to do with the story we tell about our beginnings, because he's always asking us to do our first works over. But it also has to, we have to be honest about what caused this moment. What is at the heart of this moment, right? That is to say, racial inequality, racial injustice isn't just simply the result of individual choices. It's structural, right? We have to admit that there's been a dual labor market where Black people are the last hired and the first fired, that we were located and relegated to a particular segment of the labor market, right? We have to talk about the dual housing market. Why is the wealth gap what it is? It's not because Black folk can't save, right? It's because we were locked out of that moment when the vaunted American middle class came into being. The New Deal, FDR brokered a deal with Southern Democrats to lock Black folk out. We couldn't gain access to that capital that produced the vaunted American middle class. This is policy. And, you know, we can't be, as Baldwin would say, we can't be innocent about what we've done, because then the innocence is the crime.
Hmm. Let me reintroduce you. And also, I do want to play one more clip. And this is from a debate that James Baldwin had with William F. Buckley. Eddie Glaude Jr. is our guest. He's chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University, where he is the James S. McDonald Distinguished University Professor of African American Studies. And it's a bit of a mouthful, but
it is,
but that's okay. That's who you are. He's also the author of a new book we're talking about called Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. And you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and call us and join the conversation. That number, 1-888-477-9499. Let me play another clip. And again, this is James Baldwin. This is a rather famous debate at the Cambridge University Union Hall. It is with William F. Buckley, who was at the time the leading U.S. conservative intellectual. And they're debating the question, has the American dream been achieved at the expense of the American Negro? And again, 1965.
Let me put it this way, that from a very literal point of view, the harbors and the ports and the railroads of the country, the economy, especially of the southern states, could not conceivably be what it has become if they had not had, and do not still have indeed, and for so long, so many generations, cheap labor. I am stating very seriously, and this is not an overstatement, that I picked the cotton, and I carried it to market, and I built the railroads under someone else's whip for nothing. For nothing.
Eddie, what is James Baldwin, again, one of those minute speeches from Baldwin that we could spend a whole hour on, but it's really powerful when he turns from the more political to the more personal, when he says, it was me, I picked the cotton.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's his, it's my inheritance, right? It's not some distant past, right? It is in our bones, it flows. Through our bloodstream, right? The country, and he, this is, you know, there's a wonderful book by Nicholas Bukala called The Fire This Time, which is an extraordinary analysis of that Cambridge debate. I would urge everyone to pick it up. Baldwin in this moment is giving voice to the heart of racial capitalism, right? That the very ways in which we think of our form of life is predicated upon the bitterness at the bottom of the cup. Right. And that this is not some mere abstraction. Right. It is embodied in the very ways in which our world, our current world, then and now, is organized. Right. So to personalize it, it's Baldwin's drama. Hmm. Right. It's the way. And can you imagine those sentences he's speaking? They actually turn up on the page. It makes you just kind of go, my God. But I think this is a critical move. It also shows, although he's an artist and although he's principally concerned with what some people would think of as just simply moral and ethical matters, Baldwin understood the material conditions at the heart of our racial problems in this country.
Did he ever talk about reparations? Did he ever ask for reparations for African Americans?
Well, not explicitly in that way. At least I haven't come across that language. Someone else might have. But he's always talking about repair, mm-hmm. right? And that's what reparations actually is, right? It's how do we repair what we've done, right? It's not enough to say, it's not enough to confess one's sins. One has to be different, yes? And so that's part of the work.
Help us understand his relationship with Martin Luther King.
Oh, it's complex. He loved King dearly, wrote an early several essays on King, the Dangerous Road before Martin Luther King Jr. It's just an extraordinary essay he wrote for Harper's, I believe. He supported Dr. King's SCLC. He helped raise funds. But, you know, in No Name in the Street, he acknowledges that Dr. King kind of looked at him askance, right? Mm-hmm. Didn't quite know what to do with him. I think that had a lot to do with his sexuality. I think it had a lot to do with his politics as well. But at the end of the day, when the country created the conditions for King's assassination, it is something that profoundly changed him. He never recovered from that assassination.
To the point where he either thought of or considered suicide?
He tried
to kill himself after King's assassination.
In 69, yeah, I mean, the failed relationships, you know, Baldwin says he's hurt many of people because he didn't believe he could be loved. It goes back to the wound of those early days with his stepfather, calling him too ugly to be loved in some ways. So failed relationships and, of course, the collapse of the civil rights movement in some ways. He was overwhelmed by, you know, the murder of Dr. King. Billy Dee Williams was there at the guest house in L.A. when he got the call, and Baldwin just collapsed and wept, and tried to figure out how to pick up the pieces, not only for himself, but for us in some ways.
Margaret from Narberth asks, I haven't read Baldwin for many years, but would like to reintroduce myself to his writing in addition to your book, Eddie Claude. Do you have suggestions of where I should start?
You know, I'm thinking, you know, for me, I argue in the book that his most important piece of nonfiction, and people debate me on this, is No Name in the Street, published in 1972. If The Fire Next Time is the prophetic call, is prophecy, then No Name in the Street is reckoning. This is the moment in which this is the first book he writes after King's assassination. You know, he did some interviews with Margaret Mead, which became Rap on Race, and he did the interview with Nikki Giovanni and some other journalistic pieces. But this is the first book, and it is a book about wound and trauma. It's a book about fractured memory. So I think it's an important book to begin with. But if you want, buy the Library of America edition, and you can read him from the beginning to the end.
We're almost up on a second break here, but as you mentioned trauma, but as you write that really trauma infused so much of his writing.
Yeah, you know, he's constantly grappling with not only the trauma of his individual experiences. I mean, Baldwin, when you read his work and you read biographies, you know, the predators who are preying on him. You can't help but feel that he's been the object of sexual violence, right? The sense of his own misfittedness, if that makes sense. And then the pain of being black in this country. Oh my God. And it's all, it guides his eyes. It drips from his pen. Wound and traumas everywhere, especially post King's assassination.
That's Eddie Glaude Jr., our guest on Radio Times today. We're talking about James Baldwin, the subject of his new book called Begin Again. And again, Eddie's the chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We've got one more clip as well that I do want to play. And we want you to join our conversation as we struggle with this moment we're in. And perhaps James Baldwin can help us see our way through it. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
On WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Eddie Glaude Jr. about James Baldwin and his new book, Begin Again. Let me get Steve from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, okay. Good morning, Dr. Glaude. My name is Steve Bryant. I live in Philadelphia. I have a 1 degree separation relationship with Dr. Glaude. I mean, with Mr. Baldwin.
With Mr. Baldwin, okay.
Dr. Glaude?
Yes, sir.
I met him in college. I was blessed to have met him in college and in grad school. Of course, I was in awe of him. Like all my other fellow students were. But my dad, I lived with my dad in Philadelphia before he died, and he revealed something to me. He was actually friends with Jimmy, as his friends would call him. My dad was initially friends with Baldwin's brother, David, who was a bartender at McHale's, and it happened to be my dad's hangout.
Well, my goodness. Yeah. Anyway, we're learning a lot about you, Steve.
Yeah. But anyway, they were drinking philosophies over at McHale's, where they were hang buddies.
Yeah.
And my dad was pretty erudite. And I guess, and it was close enough to where my dad even was a guest at the house in Provence.
Oh, that's great.
But anyway.
Steve, I appreciate it.
Yeah, but anyway.
We're doing a little dance here, Steve. No, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. And it's wonderful, Eddie, to hear the sort of those passionate memories.
Yeah. You know, one of the blessings I've had with this book is that I developed a wonderful relationship with Carol Weinstein, who was David Baldwin's partner, the mother of Daniel Baldwin, David Baldwin's son. And she told me about Maquette Michaels and that the times they would have there, the times that they had at the house in Istanbul and St. Paul de Vence. You know, let's put it this way. Baldwin lived fully. and there are a number of folks with stories like the caller. Yeah.
Well, and he lived some of his life in Paris, some of it in Istanbul. Did that give him a perspective on America he couldn't get living here?
Well, it certainly gave him places to breathe, you know. You know, sometimes, the day-to-day cuts, the daily grind of being in the country can wear to the bone, you know. And so you have to figure out how to create that distance. For Jimmy, it meant leaving in order to say something more substantive about America. Because, you know, that it's all in the interior, right? No matter where you are, this place comes, you know, travels with you. It's in the gut, as it were. You get at least some air so that you can actually think a little bit more carefully about the place.
Is that true for you as well?
It certainly was true in Heidelberg. You know, I didn't get this book organized until Heidelberg, right? I thought I was going to write this biography of Baldwin, and I was having trouble with archival sources and wondering something new I could say, trying to figure out my voice in relation to Jimmy's voice, not wanting to lose my voice in writing about such a towering figure. And as soon as I landed in Heidelberg, I saw white cops with knees in the back of a black man's, and he was screaming at the top of his lungs. And I went back and journaled, and there was the kernel for the book.
Let me quote something so related to what you just said there, but something else from James Baldwin, which I think speaks to, again, this moment we're in, especially when it deals with police brutality. He said, if one really wishes to understand how justice is administered in a country, one does not question the policemen, the lawyers, the judges, or the protected members of the middle class. One goes to the unprotected and listens to their testimony. And we're getting some of that today. I mean, some of it caught on video, you know, because we're watching a man die underneath the knee of a police officer. But he says, talk to the unprotected and find out what's going on.
Yeah, you know, that comes out of No Name in the Street, which is, you know, I remember interviewing Angela Davis for the book. And, you know, she talked about it in so many ways. Jimmy was out there by himself. And in some ways, No Name in the Street is probably one of the first books that we could describe as part of carceral studies, because he's thinking about the Safe Streets Act. He's thinking about what a form of policing is doing and how it's producing these outcomes. And yes, here we are in this moment still grappling with it. You know, Jimmy has this very provocative line. He says, we're still living under the slave codes. Right. And so here we are watching for 8 minutes and 46 seconds of public lynching and having to grapple with what it reveals. And also the pornography of black suffering and black death. It's an unsettling dialectic, yes.
We heard James Baldwin talking about essentially there was no difference between the North and the South. And Eddie, you write in your book, the complex web of race and sex immobilized the South. One needed only to look carefully at the people to see what happened after the sun went down, betrayed the lie of hardcore segregationists. And you talk about the fact that under the cover of night, the very people they despised as less than themselves became the object of their carnal desire. Monstrous intimacies defied the region and gave life to a host of fantasies that regularly debase men and women, especially white men and women, and fueled the lies that sought to hide all in plain sight. And in many ways, I feel like that paragraph kind of encapsulates, again, this moment that we're in, the lie.
It is everywhere.
Don't answer
that. The lie is everywhere. The lie is everywhere. It distorts and disfigures our characters. And Baldwin in that moment is saying, how could these people are lying to themselves every day, you know? I mean, you could just look at my family, you know, green eyes, light skin, right? Straight hair. My dad is the darkest of all of his siblings, right? You know what happened, right? The Glauds on the other side of town are white, and then you got the black Glauds, as it were, right? And then Baldwin is trying to grapple with this understanding. You knew that you were selling your child. You knew who that was on the auction block, and yet you still did it, right? What does that say about who you are? And here we are in this moment, knowing damn well you would never shoot a white kid, a white drunk man running away from you in the back like they did Rashard Brooks, knowing damn well you would never do it. Sit a knee on his neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, or burst in a house in a suburb and shoot, you know, whomever you would shoot, like you did Breonna Taylor. You know damn well you wouldn't do it. Hmm. Right? What does this say about the character here? And Baldwin says that we're constantly telling ourselves lies in order to protect ourselves from the actual monsters that we've become.
I mean, clearly he's angry at America, and there's much to be angry about. Did he hate America?
No, hate is too corrosive. You know, even in that moment when in Esquire magazine interview in 1968, and they're asking him about, you know, the urban rebellions, and he's saying, how can we get the black people to cool it? He said, it's not for us to cool it. Well, aren't you dying fastest? No. Aren't you the ones dying? He said, no, we're just simply the ones dying the fastest. Mm. And then they ask him, what would you say to these people who are burning down cities? He says, well, I certainly wouldn't tell them that they shouldn't pick up the gun. I certainly wouldn't tell them that they shouldn't do what they're doing. But, you know, they may very well have to, you know, blow someone's brains out. But if they do so, and it may come to that, he says, just don't hate.
Hmm.
Right. And because he understands how hatred is corrosive of the soul. It transforms us into monsters. So, no, hating America. No. That's not it at all.
But is he saying it's OK to kill someone but not hate them?
He's saying that in a moment of revolution, anything can happen. And what we have to do is understand it, right? That doesn't mean we're condoning it, but we have to understand it. So one of the things about Baldwin and Black Power, Mark, is that he wants us to understand. We tend to tell the story of these two moments, the Black freedom struggle of the Civil Rights Movement, of Dr. King and Black Power, as if they're separate historical moments filled with different people. And what he wants to say is that, look, these are folks who were risking everything in nonviolent action. Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, you know, Cortland Cox, Muriel Tillinghast. These are young students who risked everything in the bowels of the South nonviolently. And as they, you know, Stokely Carmichael would then end up, you know, decrying Freedom Now, calling for Black Power. We have to understand we produced these children, Baldwin said. They are ours, right? But, you know, we tell ourselves the story as if they just come out of nowhere.
Yeah. Let me get, Melba calling us from Bangor, Maine. And Melba, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Yes, I'm from Bangor, Pennsylvania.
Oh, Bangor, sorry.
Yes.
No,
yes.
Sorry about that, Melba.
But,
go ahead.
I'm a writer. I care deeply about words. And I'm very sensitive to what I call verbal shorthand. Earlier in the interview, the professor cited some remarks that James Baldwin made in a meeting with Kenneth Clark. I believe he said it was in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
And the professor said that black people are not the problem. It is entirely up to the American people. Now, who exactly are the American people? Mm-hmm. Are we talking about white Americans? Are we talking about all Americans? Who exactly are Americans? And just one other point on that issue. When the current occupant of the White House speaks about American people, not the same as when Elizabeth Warren is talking about American people. So who exactly are we
sure.
talking about?
Melba, I appreciate the call to Radio Times from Bangor, Pennsylvania. Eddie, go ahead.
So, you know, excuse the noise. This is part of the challenge of being in the suburbs, I suppose. So Baldwin is constantly in, you know, Baldwin's we in the early days of his writing kind of moves back and forth. So on the one hand, he's talking about white America, and on the other hand, he's talking about all Americans, right? So the problem is not us. The problem is white America. But at the same time, how we resolve it, all of us must be engaged in this. All of us must do so. So he's moving on several different levels here. And we have to kind of keep track of it as we follow him on the page. I hope you heard that, given all of the noise.
Yes, the sound of lawnmowers. Yeah, the bane of remote broadcasting. Eddie, you and I have talked about this before. Back in 2016, you were a critic, you were not a fan, I should put it that way, of Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party as well, and essentially said, look, if you're not in a battleground state, just leave it blank. And if you're African-American, leave it blank. And then, of course, you know, we know who got elected president of the United States. Where do you stand on that? And do you see Donald Trump as just part of who we are as Americans?
So let me just answer from the back, you know, the last part of it. We can't exceptionalize Donald Trump. When we exceptionalize him, we displace our sins onto him. And we believe that the only thing we need to do is get him out of office and then everything will be fine. That's just not true. Donald Trump is a reflection of the rot that's at the heart of the country. And we need to understand that. In terms of my position in 2016, you know, I've written in Begin Again that, you know, I should have known better as a lifelong reader of James Baldwin. I actually overestimated white America. I did not think they would elect someone so clearly unqualified to be the president of the United States. So I thought at the time that we had space, because for 8 years we had to mute issues of race. We had to mute it because we were protecting Barack Obama's left flank. You know, we were protecting him from kind of racist backlash, as it were, and people were kind of quiet and inhaling the state about what was happening in black communities. We needed to bring it to the fore instead of participating in this, you know, yearly, you know, election ritual of herding black people to the polls like cattle chewing cud. So I thought I had space to push the party, to break the back of Clintonism in some ways, to help break the back of Clintonism. But, you know, Baldwin reminds us, as he did in 1979, when he had to choose between the austerity policies of Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan. He says, sometimes black folk don't have anything to vote for, but we vote just simply to buy ourselves some time. Hmm. I should have remembered that.
Here's an email from John who said, how does Mr. Glaude feel about the formation of a black political party to challenge the white establishment in the American political system? What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's been done before. It has its utility. I mean, what we need to understand is that the electoral political process is the last thing we do. We need to organize. We need to organize on the ground like folk are doing. We've seen the outcomes, the effects of that organizing, particularly around policing. What we're seeing today is the result of ongoing work by grassroots activists. How can I put this? Bob Moses put it this way. He said that when we place all of our cards or all of our faith in the electoral process, it could easily demobilize our efforts to organize communities.
We're almost out of time here, and this is such a cliche question, but to you, Eddie, then, if James Baldwin were alive today, what do you think he would think of America?
You know, I don't ever dare to try to put words in that man's mouth. I think the only thing we need to do is read him. And if we read him closely, we'll see that he is saying something about America today. You know, there's a wonderful line, and I'll say this really quickly, in his essay, Black Power, right? And it's an extraordinary line because he's trying to say that in some ways America is a monotonous joke. He puts it like this, Marty. I'm trying to find the passage really quickly before we run out of time.
I'm trying to stop time. No, go ahead.
He's, you know, it's this line where he says, you know, America's like a monotonous joke, an exceedingly monotonous minstrel show, he says. The same dances, same music, same jokes. One has done or been the show so long that one could do it in one's sleep. It's like a monotonous minstrel show. We need to get off the stage. That's what we need to do.
Well, Eddie Glaude Jr., always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And his book is Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. And again, he's chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.